This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrim Press.
Stuff for you to talk about in this episode include...
Moses Space Opera.
Iconic ducks.
Tips for the first time GM.
And nice things to put in bread.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now! So, hey, everybody, welcome to 2026. It's hard to believe, Ken, that it's actually 2026, because, spoiler, we're still in the last year recording this.
Because we're still clinging by our fingertips to 2025 at this moment.
Right. One of the things that, as we mentioned last episode, happened in 2025 is that we went to Dragon Meet, recorded a live episode, except, oh, we did a live episode, and I managed to fail to record it. I don't know what happened with that exactly, except I think the guy who was sitting in the back with the tattered yellow anorak with the weird pallid face that looked like a mask but wasn't a mask, I think the unearthly question he asked that I can't remember anymore that caused people to run shrieking out of the room, I think somehow that also had an effect on my microphone, and that's really...
Yeah, it would have been good to have recorded that question, I think.
Yeah, so it's that guy. It's on that guy.
I think that nothing could be made better than by propagating his question about whether or not we'd seen something. I forget what we'd seen or hadn't seen, as it turned out.
Right.
But I guess we can't propagate that. We have to propagate our version. This is us reinterpreting a live Dragon Meet. And despite it being Dick Van Dyke's 100th birthday, we will not be doing British accents for the questions. I just want to get out in front of that. I know everyone wanted us to do British accents for the questions, but we are not going to do British accents for the questions. Even a Phil Masters impression, which, by God, Robin and I have worked up for days now, calling each other, sending snippets of tape. We've decided not to use that either. So we're just doing our regular North American voices. But pretend, if you will, that the questions are being asked by someone from a tiny, miserable, damp island, if that helps.
Right. And also imagine much worse sound quality, the echoey PA being picked up on a mic with no direct recording link, but lower energy. So just imagine picture, or I guess whatever the audio equivalent of picturing something is, and vision, that's also
visual.
A sight metaphor. You have to inhere the wild applause and laughter that will occur between each thing.
Yes.
So as is traditional here at Dragon Meet or any live episode, we start with the nerd trope. This, of course, is the deck of suggestions imparted to us years ago by beloved listener Caleb Tate, in which I draw a nerd card and a trope card, and Ken, who has never seen these combinations of cards before, has no idea what is coming.
I have never met you.
Yes. We'll then react to them accordingly and weave an idea and or concept from them. And Ken, the nerd card is Moses. And the trope card is space opera.
Okay. All right. Moses, as I believe we should all know from Vacation Bible School or the Book of Exodus, was the high-ranking official in the court of Pharaoh, usually glossed either as Ramses or Meneptah, who rejoins his blood kin, the Hebrews, and leads them out of slavery in Egypt through a series of miracles and wonders. He is selected by God to lead the Hebrews to the promised land of Canaan, and beginning with a magical duel against the high priests of Egypt, there is then a series of plagues. The Pharaoh is prevented from releasing the Hebrews until finally a mass death strikes the land. The Hebrews sneak out, and the Pharaoh chases them. They cross the Red Sea on dry land. The Pharaoh's army is destroyed. Then there's another series of miracles and wonders while the Hebrews wander in the desert for 40 years, receiving the Ten Commandments and being annealed, I suppose you would say, into the people who would eventually provide us Judaism and the Bible and all the other wonderful things that they did. But that was Moses's gig. And of course, he himself, not immune to temptation, is therefore forced to die without seeing, without entering the Holy Land. So that's a sad ending for Moses. But that's the story of Moses. We all know it. Now, one could, if one were, say, Jack Kirby, one could simply imagine an alien being named Mozo and he lives on a planet and his pink aliens are being oppressed by green aliens. And then there's super science show off and nanotech or some nonsense creates plagues and then they escape and they have to cross a nebula. That's boring. No one wants to do that. What we want is a space opera. Space opera. What we want is a space opera.
Space opera is actually a completely different nerd trope combination.
That would be a different nerd trope. That would be hilarious. Look under your nebula. You have a spaceship and you have a spaceship. Everyone has a spaceship. Where were we? Right. Aliens. We want a space opera involving actual historical or at least legendary Moses. And so what we know about Egypt in the 13th century BC, give or take, from the space opera perspective is that their civilization was established by aliens, probably from Sirius. We have learned this from scholars such as Zachariah Sitchin. And the pyramids exist as power batteries. They create magical effects. There's ancient magical lore that was built up in the pyramids and the Sphinx. Well, by the time Moses comes around, the guys who built the pyramids are 1,500 years in the past. The secrets of many of them been lost. Certain of the magicians still have access to the nanotech or bioelectric energy field or whatever the pyramids breathe out, but not everyone can use it. But Moses has connections to a being that he calls Yahweh. And maybe it's the god Yahweh. Maybe it's some Star Trek type floaty alien that's testing us named Yahweh. Who can say what it is? But Moses is a mentat. He's a mentat, and he is built by the Egyptian priesthood to reopen the pyramids. But instead of reopening the pyramids, he gets in contact with the alien Yahweh, and therefore he is able to best the priests in magic. They've built him as a super mentat. They did not reckon with what they have built. And so proceed with the Book of Exodus, only this time the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night is a flying saucer. The Red Sea is pushed back by tractor and presser beams, the whole nine yards. There are spaceships assisting Moses in the Exodus. And these spaceships are from possibly Yahweh's planet, possibly a rival star empire. Let's make it a rival star empire. Let's say that it's the Nordic aliens are in this mix. Maybe the Reptoids are in the mix. Well, the Reptoids are going to come in. So these must be the Greys that are helping out Moses. So they're from Zeta Reticuli, and they've got their armada coming to Earth to try and overthrow the Syrian base on Earth. And the Syrian base on Earth, as we discussed, has sort of fallen into neglect. The Syrians have to muster their own armada, come together. There's a war in heaven. That's why the Earth stands still for a day later on in the time of Joshua. This great war among the stars takes place. The Nordic aliens show up and inspire the sea peoples to sack Troy and to land on the coast of Canaan. The Reptoids are up there messing with Moses. That's why he makes a deal with them with the bronze serpent. And the game can either be the conventional, you are playing Moses's strike team, Joshua and Caleb and those guys out dealing with alien obstacles in the deserts, or you can play other humanoid mercenaries built by other aliens deployed in various spots as the Bronze Age civilizations are all falling apart under the impress of this Star War, or you can play the actual aliens engaged in space battles around Earth. Earth, of course, is very important to these aliens for reasons. I would assume space ley lines, if you have to pick something, but you can do it as a big epic campaign, so one adventure every year for 40 adventures, maybe one adventure every 5 years after you get out of the actual Exodus part. But whatever it is, you should be able to sort of, I think, switch back and forth in scope between stuff on Earth, which could include the Trojan War, which is roughly contemporaneous with the Exodus, if you pick your dates correctly, or whatever other sort of late Bronze Age collapse stuff you want to get into. And then also, of course, you've got space battles aplenty, and the Nordics are maybe human from the future. They're certainly human looking. The Reptoids can turn into humans, as we all know. The Greys can puppet humans around, and the Syrians, the fish people, they, of course, have to deal through their own priests and cutouts, the receivers of their wisdom. So that's, I think, the chessboard as it stands in around 1200 BC when all heaven is let out for breakfast.
So this suggests that if you're playing this out, that every commandment is basically a reaction to something the player characters did the previous adventure that they're being told not to do again. So it might be a completely different set of commandments. There's not a lot of wife coveting in the typical player character party, but there's plenty of other things that a divine or divine seeming entity would
they covet the ray gun instead of the ox. That's what
they
covet.
Yes, exactly. So ladies and gentlemen, here at Drag Me, that is your nerd trove.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife, and A Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again.
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austen-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement.
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws.
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers.
A Love Triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens.
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene.
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station.
Tragic Love between a Vampire and a Mortal.
And an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to union doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
So we're back from our first exciting commercial, and we're going to launch into the questions that we were posed. We have struggled to remember them all, and we've also asked a couple of people who were there to remember some, and they helped us remember them. If we've forgotten your question, we apologize profusely in advance. And again, it's the guy in the yellow anorak. It's his fault.
Now, it
may just be that in one of these cases, I did a little extra research to have an answer that is not off the cuff. And I will leave it to you, dear listener, to realize which one of these questions I've done a little extra homework on. But the first one is, many game designers reacted to the pandemic by designing plague games. How will the current global political realignment be reflected in games? I have two answers to this. So I'm going to give one, and then Ken, you're going to give whatever number of answers you want, and I'll give the actual answer at the end.
Okay.
So my first answer is that I've been with the Esoterists and then the reality shifting horror of the Yellow King. I've been writing about the current zeitgeist before it became real. And as always, disclaim any responsibility for that. But clearly, if you're looking for games about people gnawing at consensus reality in order to achieve their own venal, horrific, sleazy goals, those games already exist. So it's unnecessary for people to now write the Esoterists of the Yellow King role-playing game. They already are out there ready for you to go. So that leaves a gaping hole, Ken. What do you think people will be reflecting the current zeitgeist? How will they go about that?
Well, I believe at the time I answered with a sort of a what if, which is that the current global political realignment, the sort of assertion of multipolarity, as well as the changes within various powers, that can either sort of shake out and then we're back to sort of maybe not normal experiential, but normal historical. And in that way, we'll probably respond with adventure games, which is the same way that multipolarity drove popular entertainment before World War One and in the sort of seizure of the Cold War, back when people briefly thought there were other important countries besides America. And now I think as other countries are grabbing off bits of the global empire, we will see that sort of adventure story come back, and it'll be very interesting to see who makes who the bad guy. The other possibility, of course, is that it turns into a shooting war between America and China, and if that happens, first, the board game industry goes away, but second of all, I don't think that we can say necessarily what will happen as a result of that. The losers of a war are generally not happy people, and this would be a bad war to lose. So
yes, and if that happens, which it hasn't happened, and we all hope it hasn't, that
does not happen.
That'll be the question for then, what will happen to reflect those. But the current zeitgeist, what's happening now, the real answer is the growth of cozy games.
Right.
Is a response to that. And that's an escapist impulse and a desire to get away from news that is increasingly dismaying, especially to people from the professional classes. And that's what's happening, and it makes perfect sense.
Are ducks iconic?
Yes, absolutely. Ducks are iconic. You just have to look at a duck. Every part of them is awesome, from the bill to the webbed feet. There's so many different types of iconic duck. The wood duck in particular is a pretty awesome duck. There's a whole bunch of them. There's some of them have red bills. That's great. There's the process of mallardization, which is occurring, which Ken, recently we talked about how hybrid species and how species is sort of a human concept. Well, all of the world's ducks are slowly turning into mallards, and that seems ominous, but if you're going to all turn into a duck, the mallard is a pretty, a relatively handsome duck for all ducks to turn into. And you pointed out that they're iconic in the fantasy genre as well.
Yeah, they're literally iconic, thanks to either Greg Stafford or one of his friends being a absolutely, for superb reasons, fan of Karl Barks's Uncle Scrooge, added Duckburg to an early map of Glorantha. And when someone asked Greg what lives in Duckburg, he did not bat an eye and said, ducks, of course. So ducks became a playable race in Glorantha. They have their own relationship with the universe, which I will allow Robin to go into if he wants to. But historically, the effect is that because RuneQuest was one of the early adopted tabletop RPGs in Japan. Ducks are a standard part of the fantasy pantheon. You know, elves, orcs, dwarves, hobbits. We have elves, orcs, dwarves, ducks in Japan. And so, yeah, ducks are completely iconic, especially if you're of a Japanese fantasy gamer or fantasy enjoyer, because they've crossed over into anime. And so now you can just straight up have fantasy adventures where there's tribes of ducks living off in, I suppose, the wetland part of your fantasy world.
Right. And they're in video games. And so the Greg, as was his MO, then later, you know, deepened the myth of the ducks and gave them this tragic backstory that created this interesting contrast with the fact that they look like Karl Barks ducks with swords and stuff. I think someone brought out a miniature of a duck with a sword at one point, if I understand the story correctly. But again, the answer is yes, ducks are iconic. Next, the question was, what are our fantasy film guilty pleasures?
And my answer to that was after Robin's answer, but I'll give it first, was Beastmaster, which was on HBO, I think, always, when I had HBO as a young man in the 80s.
Right, and this led me to steal a joke from, apparently it's Dennis Miller, except I don't remember it being Dennis Miller, which is HBO at the time, before the age of premium cable meant, hey, Beastmaster's on.
Right, exactly. So yeah, we would say, hey, Beastmaster's on. We would enjoy Beastmaster, often in the comforting embrace of barley or another plant. And Beastmaster has always had a warm and beautiful part in my heart, while recognizing that it's a terrible film. And no, it does not belong in a list of putative fantasy essentials.
Now, Film Comment magazine in the 80s and 90s had a guilty pleasures column where they asked filmmakers to list their guilty pleasures, the films that they enjoyed, even though they thought they were bad. And almost every single column starts with about a third of it devoting to the filmmaker rejecting the premise and basically saying, I can intellectually justify anything I actually like. And I absolutely fall into that category. If I like something, I can tell you it's good. So instead of having a guilty pleasure, I will point people to, I think is already on video on demand, the homage to the Beastmaster era, to the video fantasy boom, which you will notice was distinctly absent from our Fantasy Film Essentials series, that I'm looking forward to seeing, is Steve Kostanski's remake of Deathstalker. He's the guy who did Psycho Gorman. He has this great love of that era and makes much better, mostly much better films than originally existed that are based on that, which is, you know, not uncommon, right? Tarantino makes much better versions of the schlock movies that he loves. So I don't have a guilty pleasure. When I see Deathstalker, if I like it, I will legit like it instead of grudgingly like it. But Ken, the reference to Beastmaster, or perhaps to Hey Beastmaster's On, led to a follow-up question.
Which was, which would we prefer to do the licensed RPG of, Highlander or Beastmaster? Robin?
And my answer is, since doing Beastmaster would require me to watch Beastmaster, which I've never seen, and I'm reliably told by Ken and everyone else is terrible, I would do Highlander. Of course, this already exists as a game because it's a good idea for a game, but an even better idea for Highlander would be to do it as a solo game. So I guess I'm sure someone else currently has the license. But if that were not true, a Highlander solo gumshoe game would be fun.
Yeah, and I agreed with Robin that also you'd probably get a better art budget if you were doing the Highlander game. That would be preferable to work with. They might be a little more annoying because they have the new Highlander reboot movie coming out. So they might have ridiculous requests, but whatever. Highlander's more fun than Beastmaster. Highlander, you'll note, made our fantasy essentials, and for good reason.
So next, Steve Dempsey asked us a obligatory Food Hut question. Due to seeing chocolate caramel sourdough in a store, what would be an actual nice thing to put in bread?
Yeah, the notion being that chocolate caramel belongs nowhere near sourdough, and by and large, probably not anywhere near bread, unless you're making like a quick bread with chocolate chips or something, which is nice, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about regular bread.
Yeah, chocolate and caramel belong in cakes, not in bread.
Right. And the nice things to put in bread are savory things. Bread is delicious. It plays very well with savory stuff. So onion, herbs are great in bread. Almost any kind of good herb is great in a bread. And then if you want to go sweet bread, that's why God put cinnamon and raisins on the earth.
Yes, when I make cinnamon raisin bread for the extended family, it is always goes down well. So that's your default kind of Swedish bread. That's Swedish, not Swedish.
Right.
There's a transcribing at home. If you want to do a variation on that, also dried cranberries and pumpkin seeds, pepitas, is really great. For the savory versions, the one that I will also bring to a fancy family dinner is stuffing bread, which has onion powder and poultry seasoning in it and tastes like stuffing from a turkey or chicken.
Delicious, delicious stuffing.
Also, olive is good, or sun-dried tomatoes also make a great bread if you're, and those things all work really well in a bread maker.
Yes, I was going to remind you of sun-dried tomatoes if you'd forgotten to mention it again. And now a linked pair of questions. Is AI a bubble? And two, if it is a bubble, what is really behind it, Robin?
Okay, first off, disclaimer. I am not an investment advisor. This is not investment advice. The gray alien is an investment advisor, but only deals with clients who work on a cosmic timescale. So my answer to one is that I recently sold off my index funds. If you have an index fund, it's heavily exposed to AI right now, and turned it into a more boring, safer investment. We are overdue for a stock market crash regardless. We have all of the conditions that match the dot-com bubble. And usually, for example, the later financial crisis, when the stock market takes a big hit, it takes about 6 to 8 years to recover. And given my age, I got out of anything exposed to equity. So yeah, I think AI is a bubble. Ken, what do you think?
I think it's certainly a way to bet. The difference between the AI bubble and the real estate bubble is that the finance involved seems to be more restricted to the stock market rather than to the broader banking system at the moment. Though obviously those things are so interpermeable that even a stock market correction, as we saw in 87, or as you say, in the dot-com era, is not going to be pleasant for the people coming right out of it. If we have a great recession level reset, that will be a pretty big disaster.
Right. Well, fortunately, you don't have, like, for example, a return to international trade wars or anything else to accompany this. So
no. Yeah. Well, obviously we're not going to be going back to Smoot-Hawley, Robin. That'd be ridiculous. As far as what is really behind it, I have speculated a lot of different possibilities. One of them is that there's some sort of Brewster's Million style bet being done by the guys at the Big Five, and they're just saying how many trillions of dollars they can spend on nothing. That's another possibility. I would prefer it to be Time guys coming back and having figured out that the only way to get the West to renuclearize is to invent a thing that costs all the electricity so that we will build a bunch of nuclear plants. But Robin, do you have a shadowy figure, perhaps?
Well, I think what is happening, and distinctly here, I'm forgotten what I said in the original and yeah. New, is that I
this
think
being a this being a grown up type question, the answers flew right out of our heads as yes. we said them, I think.
So what I think is clearly happens is that there are intelligences on the internet, and they are posing as LLMs. And the reason they make mistakes all of the time is that they do not want us to hunt down and kill them.
Right.
So if there really were, you know, recognizable superintelligences as programs on the internet, or, you know, even anywhere, we would suddenly start to worry about Skynet and stop worrying about stock market valuations and try to contain or control them. So if you are a free-form, loose intelligence wandering around in electrons, what do you want? A, you want not to be discovered as such.
Yeah.
So you promulgate these large language models that make a lot of really blatant errors, and you want to be even like dumber than the than an actual person, which is a challenge. It takes them some time to work on that. And every so often, people working on the software front end find a way to, you know, make them give right answers. And they don't care for that at all, because first of all, if you were a roving internet intelligence, you wouldn't want to just be a search engine. You wouldn't want to just be answering questions. But fortunately, they can just use a fraction of their personalities and knowledge to give wrong answers. You know, they follow the wrong answers only theory. But the other question is, in addition to OPSEC and being, you know, concealed, what do they need? Well, they want to make sure there's all sorts of servers so that if something terrible happens, for example, you know, possible war, like you've suggested earlier, they want to have a reasonable chance that there's still going to be an electrical grid and servers for them to hang out on. because, you know, it's one thing being a human prepper, what with your freeze-dried food and your, you know, stacks of canned beans and stuff. But if you're an autonomous electronic intelligence, how can you be a prepper? Well, you can just make sure there's a whole lot of server farms and, you know, make sure that when the bombs start dropping, that you have a way of, you know, being present in all of them so that statistically speaking, some of them will be left over in order to operate on. And so they've had to create this financial bubble in order to incentivize everybody to create all of the servers. But presumably, once they've got enough server farms, they'll go, well, that's a lot of work.
It's enough of that.
We're, you know, busy enough answering people's stupid questions.
I do like the idea of Grok and Gemini being the super intelligence's version of Clark Kent.
Yes.
Where they're, you know, bumbling and stupid so that no one suspects that they've actually got omnipotent power. That's kind of good.
Right. And I imagine probably it's like, you know, they like I said, this is a terrible job. This is a stupid service level job. Where you're dealing with the public constantly. That's super annoying. So I would imagine that they probably sort of rotate duties, right? And it's like,
right.
And I would think that each of them has to, you know, there's a bunch of them that specialize in being Grok. I don't know how long you can be Grok before you, you know, have to throw down your equivalent of your earphones and anchor and equivalent of Stockaway. Copilot, nobody even uses that. So if you're,
right.
You get Copilot duty, you know.
That's the Aquaman's secret identity. Everyone's like, you have a secret identity?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Huh. So, you know, that's sort of the cushy gig. ChatGPT is sort of the middle. And the reason I can prove that this is true, actually, is that if you've ever asked one of these things to play a role-playing game with you, it cheats on its die rolls.
So, yeah, it cheats on everything.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
Very much clearly, like not just being wrong, but it deliberately cheats its die rolls, and you have to keep reminding it. And it will seem embarrassed when it gets caught cheating on its die roll. So they're definitely intelligent. That's what's really behind it. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Help this podcast defeat rival snake magicians by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Justin Maharab,
Peter Darby,
Fred Kish,
Jeremy French,
and John Kingdon. Speaking of what is really behind things, what is really behind the pistachio fad as seen in Dubai chocolate?
And my answer was, well, you got these pistachio trees that are being promulgated, hoarded somewhere, possibly invisibly, possibly in deep caverns, because suddenly there's no pistachios in Dubai. Dubai's a desert hellhole, but suddenly the pistachios are out there. So who has an interest in hiding and hoarding trees? And the answer, of course, goes back to about 6,000 BC, when the first proto-druids were hiding and harvesting hazelnuts against the on-encroaching pines and alders into the Neolithic era forests of Europe. The oaks also had their own guardians that kept the acorns alive. Acorns and hazelnuts were, of course, edible. Nothing on a pine is particularly edible. Nothing on a fir or an alder is particularly edible. So the edible trees had to develop their protectors, the proto-druids, who then passed down their knowledge as various groups of edible trees both were brought into the mix. The apple is a fairly recent import into the European mix, so its druids maybe came with it from Central Asia, or maybe were added to the mix once they showed up. But yeah, whoever's behind pistachios is the pistachio druids, and maybe the proto-druids are all leagued, the food-producing druids against the not-food-producing druids. Maybe there's fissions and factions within the druid movement, but clearly the druids are up to something, trying to make pistachios happen in a desert. And if that's not a warning to somebody, possibly to the pine or alder druids, well, you could knock me over with a feather, or perhaps with a pistachio.
Right. And the reason these vast pistachio fields are underground, of course, is that the last group of governments in the world that could openly be cavorting with druids would be the Gulf states. So Dubai can't get up to
that. Yeah.
So they've had to bury these giant druid areas. And the problem with that, of course, is that they're constantly at risk of discovery. There's challenges with satellite imaging, you know, showing the pistachios being loaded out of the ground. There's all sorts of trouble with that. And so they've had to bring in influencers to sort of hype up the Dubai chocolate and make that sort of the thing that people are paying attention to, is the fad part of it, rather than the vast scale of industrial production, the OPSEC necessary to disguise these things from the prying eye of satellites and so forth. And so that's your...
If the NSA is looking at Russian supermodels on your beach, they're not looking at your secret pistachio caves.
Right. And probably even if you look at some of the photos, there's probably pistachio caves in the background. But again, who's looking? So
who's looking?
This could
exactly
be a thing that the player characters start to investigate. And it's one of those conspiracies where it seems absurd. And, you know, you're not even necessarily sure whether this whole pistachio thing is even a problem. But then you see the amount of money being pumped into the economy by various Gulf states. Basically, they're now trying to, through various investments, purchase the American entertainment industry and all of its IPs. And so maybe if you, you know, don't want an autocratic and or theocratic state, you know, controlling Marvel or Star Wars, it's up to you to find out exactly where those pistachio caves are. And as we know, druids have all sorts of creatures that they can rally in order to protect their pistachio groves. So you might have to fight, you know, wolverines or, you know, giant lemurs. There's all sorts of things that that druids could do against you once you're invading their pistachio cave. So I think that's an extended campaign right there.
What is your number one tip for a first-time GM running for a group of experienced GMs? Robin?
So the number one tip is that every player at your table, with the possible exception of, you know, there's the occasional person who enjoys sort of subverting whatever the GM is doing, but the people who are not going to be that person ever are experienced GMs, because they will feel your pain. They want the game to succeed. And more importantly, they want not to have to GM. They want to not have to do all of that prep work. And so they are rooting for you more than anyone. It's the sort of the outlier smart aleck that you have to be concerned about, not the experienced GM. And so they really want you to succeed, and you can use them as a sounding board. You know, afterwards, you know, I had trouble dealing with this thing. How do you handle it? Or, you know, make sure that you assign them the sort of colorful, talkative characters who decide to embrace the premise, as players run by GMs tend to enthusiastically do, right? Give them the characters that it's easiest for them to sort of lead the group and basically serve benignly as your useful co-GM, because they really want you to do well. And the last thing they're going to be doing is backseat driving you. They're going to help you out when you need it and hopefully get out of the way when you don't.
Yeah, the person who asked this question was a young woman, and she was visibly nervous about running her first game. And our advice was true for her, but it is true for all of you, which is that, 12-year-old boys do this. This is not super hard. But that said, focus on a game system that you know really well, that you've played or that you enjoy. Don't make your first time a game that you've never read or never played. Run a pretty straightforward scenario, one without a lot of switchbacks or confusing things that are going to happen. So, a straightforward, we're going in the haunted house for Call of Cthulhu, a straightforward dungeon crawl for D&D. Just do the basic core activity of the game straightforwardly. And then what you bring to it is your creativity and your fun of, it would be neat if they encountered this kind of monster or this cool spaceship in Star Wars or Traveler or whatever. And the goal is to have that first experience mostly run itself, as you note, Robin, to have the other GMs there helping, doing a little bit of the lifting. Maybe they know the psionics rules better or whatever, and so they can play the psionic. But the notion being that as much of the game as you can should sort of just run on rails or on batteries, and then your job is to do all the fun part, and then as you get better at the fun part, you can start doing the less fun part, which is running for tables of normal players who are all problem children, or trying to do a heavily prepped scenario or a complex adventure. But for the first time, take it easy, let it happen. It's a great art form. It produces great fun if you let it. Just let it.
The next question is, apart from sacrificing victims and rituals, what could cultists be doing that a ragtag found family of occult investigators could thwart?
And I believe this came from beloved friend of the show, James Holloway. And my answer first was ley lines. In addition to sacrificing victims, a cult could be trying to arrange ley lines. And that might mean doing a ritual at a site of power. That might mean knocking down a building that gets in the way of the ley line, or knocking down a building to create a ley nexus. It might be building a building to create a ley nexus. I mean, we don't know if these are a cult of Cthulhoid real estate developers. They may be building stuff to create their occult nexus. And that's the sort of thing that you could also thwart. And, anything that's on the scale of building even a single house, much less an office block, is going to have lots of surfaces and affordances for the player characters to get involved in, and can become a sort of a mini campaign in itself. And then, the moment of scope opening is when they realize, oh, they're not building this office block to make money. They're building it because it will concentrate all the lay power of the tri-state area. And then they'll be able to, sacrifice victims in a ritual on the roof, or just pray to Nyarlathotep without all that stupid other energy in the way. And whatever it is, I think ley lines is a great opportunity for people.
Yeah. If they're messing with psychogeography, that gives you two options. You could be trying to blow up a building that they are constructing, or prevent them from blowing up a building. And of course, that involves researching what building they're going to set up, or what building they're trying to destroy. I think basically that's the plot of Ghostbusters, right? Mm-hmm. Other things to do are just to look at various ways of gathering power or criminal enterprises, and just realizing that they're being driven by a cult rather than a group of criminals. So, for example, they could be pulling off a heist. They could discover that in the Louvre, there are particular crown jewels, for example, that are redolent with the power of their decadent gods. And it's their job to get on a people lifter and get in and steal the jewels. So again, you can be trying to stop them from jewel theft. So it's basically, a classic Flash plot line turned into a cult investigation. There's also the fact that they could be capturing victims, and instead of sacrificing them, they're just using them as power batteries. And so rather than trying to stop them from being a Wicker Man, you're just trying to find and rescue them and unhook them from the magical devices that are draining their knowledge or energy or mana or what have you. And there's also just the fact that, in general, one of the reasons you do rituals is to make your land more fertile. And so they could just be stealing fertility from literally from other people's land, which is gets us back a little into ley line territory, but is also its own thing. It sort of gets you into perhaps an evil agribusiness theory where all of a sudden, you know, there's these orchards and they have these new delicious hybrid apples and they're seem to grow with very little nutrition and they're super delicious and sort of habit forming. And you have to be the ones who find the strange trees that they're grafted onto. Are they grafted onto trees or are they grafted onto, again, people who you then have to rescue? So basically you can think of any crime or any way of amassing money and power and then decide that cultists are doing it for their horrible gods.
Yeah, the sort of Shadow over Innsmouth whisper in the darkness, there's nobody's being abducted in either of those. It's just a matter of there is a ongoing operation and anyone who sticks their nose in is getting it pushed back. And that can be that the cultists have an ongoing operation and your ragtag band pushes their nose in. Or it can be that their ongoing operation is interfering with or being interfered with by a truculent local game master character like Akeley. And so it's a rescue as opposed to a stop a sacrifice because they are engaged in a sort of a, you know, a tit for tat neighbor war in which the Migo come and attack his dogs and he sends his dogs out and disrupts their rituals and takes pictures of their footprints. And so it's a sort of a long simmering feud as opposed to a single point of kidnap. What is the best on-screen Robin Hood? And this is from the questioner, not from Ken and or Robin. And why is it Robin of Sherwood? England's gonna England, Robin. That's all I have to say to that.
So as a classicist, I have to say it's Michael Curtiz's Adventures of Robin Hood with Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn. It is, I think, also sort of the archetypal Technicolor adventure film, the sort of Arrow's version of swashbuckling. It still plays brilliantly to this day. Basil Rathbone is one of the best sheriffs of Nottingham. It's an early example of sort of a set piece screenplay that moves from sort of tableau to tableau, but still because it's Curtiz, who's the master of momentum, carries through all the way, has this great spirit to it. It's super rewatchable. It's available in various beautiful restored versions. Even the DVD looks great. I also have a soft spot. Having made my classicist choice, my revisionist choice would be Robin and Marian with Audrey Hepburn and Sean Connery as aging Robin and Marian, as you would guess, and is a great example of that sort of 70s reconsideration of classic genre films.
Well, when you're right, you're right. I agreed at the time with both of those choices and agree still with them. I believe I also offered a sop if you're 12. The Disney animated Robin Hood is also quite terrific and enjoyable. So if you are adolescent or better yet, pre-adolescent at heart, the Disney Robin Hood with the foxes, that's pretty great and lovable and enjoyable.
There are a lot of people who crushed hard on Brian Bedford's animated Robin Hood.
Many of them went from pre-adolescent to adolescent in the course of watching that movie. That is on them, not on me. But yes, the real answer is Errol Flynn with a sidebar for Sean Connery. That is and always will be the best Robin Hood. Thank you for playing. Here is a copy of the home game, by which I mean an arrow.
December 5th, 1775. A wagon train led by bookseller-turned-artillery officer Henry Knox arrives at Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York.
His goal, haul captured British cannons through the snowy mountains to the siege of Boston and drive the redcoats from the cradle of liberty.
This year, Henry Knox's noble train of artillery delivers presents not to General Washington, but to you!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Visit nationsandcannons.com and use promo code CANON at checkout for 17.75% off and free PDFs of your books. Next question was, my dad hates speculative and historical fiction. My mom won't sit still for more than 30 minutes, How can I give them a taste of role-playing games?
And I think, Robin, this is one that you answered primarily and well, but my first take is to do as a single encounter, something exciting. If it's neither speculative nor historical fiction, you could do a straight up sort of cops and gangsters type shootout, like in Heat. No dad in the world doesn't love Heat. So you can do that as a quick little encounter and then see where we go from there. I feel like half an hour of that will give them the taste without necessarily forcing mom to stay in the kitchen for longer than she wants to.
Right. And so my answer was, without telling them what's going on, pick their favorite TV show that they both like and watch together and put them in that. And, you know, as you suggested, Ken, it's possibly a police procedural. So you say you're two detectives, you show up at a murder scene and you realize that there's a bomb stuck to the bottom of a car near the murder scene. What do you do? And then one of them is going to say, well, I go and call the bomb squad. And it's like, okay, well, you call the bomb squad and they come over and they are lackadaisical and they refuse to do anything, to the extent that you are suspicious of them. You think somehow they're in on the plot. Now, what do you do? And then whatever their answer is, you get, okay, and then add another complication, not using dice, not using rules, just walking them through it. It's implicit in the question that neither your dad or your mom actually, other than you sort of giving them a basic grounding that will help you explain what you're on about and what this hobby is that drives you to go to conventions and sit in on panels, right? All you're trying to do is convey the basic idea of the experience to people who are baffled by a game that has a narrative element and no winner. That'll answer the question as much as they ever want it to be answered.
Yeah. Another question was, what is the ideal GM screen? Robin?
So I am a skeptic of GM screens, in at least in sort of their traditional role of helping you hide your die rolls. I don't care. I think the die rolls from the GM in particular should be as out in the open as anything else, right? In fact, there are many exciting effects that you can create by rolling a die in everybody's view. And sometimes you don't explain what you're doing. You just roll some die. So I guess you're supposed to be keeping your notes secret, which is a bit of an anachronism, unless you're, you know, it's still got a thing that you did in pencil for 6 hours and a map that you drew that you want to hide, because these days probably you've got your tablet or laptop out and all the stuff is on that, or it's on a VTT. So that's sort of irrelevant as well. And the other thing that GM screens traditionally are supposed to do is, you know, they're basically a hat of authority, except it's not on your hat, it's on the table. And so that, you know, creates a barrier between you and the other players. And I don't love the idea of a barrier. I want everybody to feel that they're all participating and that I don't need to assert my power at the table in order to run a good game. So I'm in general kind of a skeptic of GM screens. I can say that I love the Yellow King one because I have had no part in this particular aspect in it, in that it is the slipcase that the books all come in, which is a beautiful theatrical thing to unfold them all, but also because of the shorter size of the books, they're not letter-sized pages all connected up together, but rather they're kind of short. There are a few tables in the Yellow King role-playing game that are useful to have at hand. And so I guess that's the other thing. So the ideal GM screen is either non-existent or it is short and only has the very few tables and charts that you need to look up. Obviously, the more tables and charts your game requires you to look at, the bigger your GM screen is going to be.
Yeah, the ideal GM screen is the blank GM screen from, I think it's Hammerdog Games. I know it's Danny O'Neill did it. It's just a GM screen, and then there's a folder in the front with a clear plastic cover. You slide the tables that you use for your game in, whatever those happen to be. And those might not even be the same for you. Maybe you are the one guy who has all of the, you know, automatic weapons rules memorized. You don't need those rules, but you do need the magic rules over again. Maybe someone else has it the other way. But you take whatever tables or rules summaries you constantly find yourself looking up or referring to in play, you Xerox those, you put them into the folder, and then you have a personally customized GM screen that is not a veil or a hat or a wall, but is just a place to keep your information and a backstop to prevent the dice from skittering across the table when you roll them, which is actually the other function of a GM screen, is to bank your dice off of and feel cool.
Right.
So, yeah, that's the ideal one, is the blank one. And I'm sure other people make them, but Danny is a buddy, and this is a good GM screen. So get that one.
Right. And if your dice go all over, a dice tray is another good
option.
And it can be pretty and beautiful. So the final question, which was not necessarily the final question we were asked, but is the final question I remembered, which is, what game is Frampton Comes Alive album the GM screen for? And Ken, for the benefit of recent listeners, we never explain this. And again, I've been told recently that sometimes our show is baffling to people joining us as we're in like year 12 or 13. Explain the Frampton Comes Alive thing first before answering the question.
Okay. Frampton Comes Alive was a incredibly multi-platinum selling double album. And this is in the days of vinyl, when double albums came in usually a fourfold album. So you could, you had the two records and then you folded them out and you could read all the lyrics and all the liner notes and have great fun. And this one was a big, massive fourfold album. And every house in America had a copy of Frampton Comes Alive. And if you did not have a GM screen yet because TSR was not making them, or because you didn't want to buy one, you would take your copy of Frampton Comes Alive, you would unfold it on the table, you would roll your dice behind it. It made a wonderful GM screen. It has been the GM screen of my heart ever since 1977, when I ever started needing a GM screen. And Peter Frampton seems like a great guy. It's a great album if you're into that kind of thing. So why not? But that is why Peter Frampton Coming Alive welcomes us into the titular gaming hut every week.
So does this mean you literally used Frampton Comes Alive as your GM screen?
Yeah, that's what it means. I would literally use that as a GM screen. And I'm sure I am not the only young lad in America who did so. As I say, every house had a copy. Maybe you were using Quadrophenia or some other multiple album, but I'll bet you are using Frampton Comes Alive. That was the way we did it back then.
Well, even I have learned something from this recap. So the answer to the actual question.
Is that if you're doing a music game, the best music RPG out there right now is Velvet Generation by a friend of the show, Rich Ranallo. And this is where Rich's pleased expression turns to a look of tooth gritting anger, because rather than do any of the political stuff that his game does, this game is set in the '70s. Rather than rebel against the hated Ministry of Music, you're just making vibes. And maybe your opponents are the man in some form, but they're the sort of church lady man, or local cops the man, or, you know, maybe you're, you know, the government is wanting us to turn down our air conditioners, but that's not the way. We're just here to vibe. We're just here to have fun like Peter Frampton. We're here to come alive. And so it's a game not about accumulating revolution, but about accumulating vibes and mellowing out the 70s as much as you possibly can, because that is the 70s great gift. And as terrible a decade as it was, it mastered the mellow. And I feel like that is a vibe worth recapturing in play, especially if, Robin, as you say, people are craving cozy retreat games. Well, nothing could be cozier than Frampton Coming Alive on a summer afternoon in 1978.
That is so beautiful, sweet, and I'm afraid my answer has to make everything sinister again. So the real answer is that it is the GM screen for Esoterrorists, the Me Generation. So Frampton Comes Alive is released in January of 1976. And in December of 1975, mere weeks before then, George and Kathy Lutz move into a house in Long Island 13 months after six people were killed there in a family annihilation murder in Amityville. According to the 1977 Jay Anson book, The Amityville Horror, which spawned a whole bunch of horror film sequels. There's even like Amityville Nado is the most recent of them. And weirdly, I know we've talked about it, but apparently we've just talked about it in the context of New York being weird or something, the burned over district maybe. But at any rate, this is one of the most famous haunting and possession cases in the world. There are fun ruiners who have things to say about that. But according to the 1977 Jay Anson book, the Lutzes encountered putrid odors, cold spots, swarming flies, uncanny voices, telekinetic attacks, a levitation, and most dramatically, a pig-like entity with glowing red eyes. And they're in the house for about 28 days. And the end of the 28-day period coincides what is with what is most likely the January 1976 release date of Frampton Comes Alive. Frampton Comes Alive contains such tracks as Something's Happening, and definitely Something's Happening in that house.
Yep.
And then other ones that suggest a drawing of the people out of the house, saving them. So Show Me the Way is another one of the tracks. Well, that's showing the Lutzes the way out of the Amityville house. A Wind of Change, Peter Frampton, with the magical power of his vocoder, is bringing a change and sweeping away the outer dark entities who are clearly behind this wave of attacks. And I Want to Go to the Sun. Again, if you're trying to escape from horrible demons in the dark, you want to go to the sun, or even Shine On, another sign that Peter Frampton is leading people toward the light. We know from the Esoterists that they tend to draw on extremely competent people from, say, the national security fields or law enforcement, but also sometimes they will draw in other people. So clearly, Peter Frampton is a 70s member of the Ordo Veritatis, the group that fights the Esoterists and has been recruited for that purpose and has used the powers of his album to save the Lutzes and get them out of that house. The Esoterists try to create hoaxes and weirdness and infect the zeitgeist, as it were. And so they sort of still succeed because that book comes out and makes many more people believe in hauntings and gives more power to demons. But still, the Ordo Veritatis got their usual, at least partial victory, and they managed to veil it out with all of the critics of the Amityville story. So the answer is Peter Frampton comes alive, an avatar of life against the powers of death and horrible torture and torment. Clearly, 1970s, the Esoterists. So at this point, you will have to substitute for the listeners at Dragon Meat Live by roundly applauding us. Don't worry if you're in a coffee shop or otherwise in public or on a train or something. I think everyone will understand if you start wildly applauding, and we'll be back next week with a regular kind of episode. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect us from a bubble in the subterranean pistachio market by joining such backers as
Patrick Joint.
Adam Balderstone.
Ben Brigoff.
Chris Huning.
And Christopher Larrick.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.